welcome to LOA Today.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I've been doing this podcast since September of 2012, and boy, are my lips tired.
This is your daily dose of happy. We are so happy you decided to join us today.
And our friend Anne Marie can't join us today. She's dealing with the fact that in the UK, they're in the midst of a switch over to daylight savings time like we did a couple weeks back. And it kind of affects what goes on with her kids. So she'll join us again next week. But today I am joined by Dr. Leanna Wolf, who is the author of 177 Lovers and Counting. No, that's not quite what you think it is, but we're going to find out what it really is in just a moment. This is an interesting story and one I've been looking forward to because she has her start in San Francisco in the 1970s when a lot of stuff was going on. So I'm going to be kind of curious to know about that stuff that was going on and how it led to her career. But Dr. Wolf, welcome to the program. How are you doing
today? Thank you so much.
Glad to have you here. So, okay, tell us the story because, well, we love stories. Everybody loves stories.
Well, we all love stories. Yeah. So I was a student at Berkeley in the early 1970s. And this was basically in the thick of the sexual revolution and second wave feminism. And there were all kinds of iconic folks that were a hair older than me that were generating all kinds of theory and direction in terms of how sex worked and who you should be having sex with and how women's bodies worked, etc. And so I'm this young early 20s, late teens person, and I'm reading things like The Myth of the Vaginal Orgasm and The Height Report and trying to figure out for myself what is all this about and what and does any of it pertain to me? And and so basically the idea behind the myth of the vaginal orgasm was Freud's contention back in the 19th century that mature women had vaginal orgasms and adolescent women had clitoral orgasms. And as far as I could tell, I didn't have orgasms. And I needed to figure this out as fast as I could because there was so much conversation about it.
Oh, yeah.
So
especially
at
Berkeley at that time. I mean, that was the hotbed.
It was. And so I'm in what were then called women's consciousness raising groups. And I was in my group and we largely talked about sex and guys and how everything worked. And I asked somebody in the group, well, have you guys had an orgasm and how do you do it? And so someone suggested to me that I run a stream of warm water in while lying in the bathtub and time it at just a certain temperature and a certain speed and place my crotch under it. And so I did that. And lo and behold, I had an orgasm. And I was so excited, I told my boyfriend to come into the bathroom and see how it worked.
I love it.
But the two of us were never able to figure out how to make that work with intercourse. Or because we were very young and there wasn't the internet out there telling folks all kinds of stuff. And there wasn't, all the educational and titillation websites that there are today. So that's a bit of my trying to figure it out story. And then several years later, I was living in San Francisco when the late Joni Blank opened up the first women-centered vibrator store. It was called Good Vibrations. And it turned out it was in my neighborhood. And so I walked up very soon after it opened and she said, oh, we have test rooms here. Try out these vibrators.
I love it.
And so I went into a test room and they all worked. And so I came back very red and smiling. And she says, excuse me, those were for testing, not for trying. So anyway, I tried them all and they were all effective.
Oh, that's funny. That's a great story.
Well, these pieces are in the play I perform, which is by the same title as my book. And so what happened is I decided at some point when I was procrastinating heavily on the book that I should just make it into a play. And so I have all these hilarious scenes like that, these in the play. And then eventually, because of the pandemic, I was so isolated, I actually wrote the book and actually found a publisher, and it came out in January. And because I'm a professional anthropologist, they published it as a textbook. So hopefully all of your listeners who are studying anthropology this fall will be assigned this book. Or if you're not personally assigned it, maybe you can track it down for extra credit and do a review of it or something. Anyway.
Sounds like a plan to me. By the way, one of our longtime listeners, Barbie, is in the live stream, and she gave me the laughing with tears coming out of her eyes emojis. Perfect.
So this was like some of my orgasm research when I was about 20 or a little older than that. And then I also had done research as soon as I was out of Cal, trying to figure out seduction. Because I was like coming of age in, you know, the thick of second wave feminism, where all the guys were very concerned about not being male chauvinists. And so they were all very sort of polite and non-aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I somehow thought that there was more to seduction than just being fair and splitting the bill. And because that's what I did with my boyfriend, is like, I'd say, okay, the diaphragm jelly costed $9. So you owe me $4.50.
Oh, that's funny.
So I end up in Mexico with the intention of living in Mexican villages, as some of my anthropology professors had done. And I actually did manage to do that. But when I wasn't in a village, I was being hit on constantly by Mexican men because I was all of 22 and extremely cute and unescorted. So suddenly I found out very quickly through, I guess, the research method of anthropology called participant observation, where we both engage as well as reflect about machismo. And there, feminism hadn't yet hit Mexico. So I was basically being taken on these extremely seductive dates and having men who had no problem whatsoever with forcing or imposing intense seduction on me. And so it was a whole other set of learning.
Yeah.
And I realized I liked it.
Okay.
And feminism was, in terms of how I was had been engaging it in Berkeley, was kind of flat relative to having a guy who's very direct and very imposing and take me on a wild date.
That's really interesting. That it's interesting too how that has, in many ways, made a comeback since that time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's like, at this point, there's a lot of interest in our culture in kink. And a fair amount of kink has to do with dominance and submission. And, you know, I found out, you know, at that point that I actually had an appetite for some of that. And it was pretty fun. And when I made my way to graduate school in New York in the late 70s, I was dating somebody who was basically engaging me in BDSM, and I had no idea that it had a name or a subculture or anything. All I knew is that he was pinning me on the bed and slapping my butt, and it was really fun.
Wow. That's really interesting. It's interesting how your background starting at Berkeley sounds like it paved the way to the larger set of experiences. It established a groundwork, if you will. And through that foundation, yeah, I mean, because we all have a starting point of our, any part of our lives, sexual or otherwise. And that starting point obviously informs how we're going to look at the world. But the Berkeley perspective, the one that is, like you say, it was at the forefront of the sexual revolution, the very early stages of it. It creates a foundation that's different from what I would say most people's experiences growing up, coming of age and so forth. And I guess that leads to ultimately the question in my mind, do you feel like that foundation gave you experiences as you went to Mexico and elsewhere that you wouldn't have otherwise had, or do you think you would have gotten down that road anyway?
I think really what the thing was with me is that I was shy and curious. And so also for whatever it was, I was very willing to experience and try things that had no objective, like marriage. 'Cause in a lot of places, people only date to find a partner to marry and propagate with. And there's arranged marriages where, you know, one person is created, is matched to another person, and they, you know, their families do an assessment, or a matchmaker does an assessment, and they're, you know, looking at everything from background to intelligence to looks to astrology if they're from India, and, you know, assess if they're a good match. I think from the very beginning, I was dating for data. and it was just like I would have all these experiences, and I was not at all, you know, like if some guy in Mexico, you know, like invites me to stay in his casita for a week, I was 100% sure I wasn't auditioning him for marriage. I was simply seeing what he was like and what his world was like. And to me, that was acceptable. You know, it's really interesting because at one point there was this TED talk with a woman who had come up with an algorithm, because she's a data scientist, for how to find a proper match for herself. And one of the things she had noted is that women who show a bit more skin in their pictures get more hits from all kinds of people. And so even if you're a smart person who, you know, may be typically leading with your brain because you're some kind of sapiosexual, nonetheless, if you show some skin, you might, you know, do better. So she did that with her photos, but then just from the comfort and safety of her home computer, she picked one person, met him, knew he'd be right, and he was. And they got married and started a family. And when I read about this, I thought, I date for data. I don't want to meet the right person so fast or so efficiently. I love all these adventures that I've had by meeting people that may be incredibly inappropriate, but are fascinating.
So as you look back on your life and look back at the various men you've met over, well, I'm making an assumption there, the various people
you've met. You are making an assumption.
So I'll be careful about the assumptions, but as you look back and you think about the various people you've met in your life, what stands out? I mean, you were collecting data. At some point you turned the data into a theory. What's your theory?
Many theories. There's hardly one theory. And at different times I was looking at different things, and I've ultimately done a fair amount of research, which is actually detailed in my book, because my book is about my life as a sex researcher. So there were a number of things that led to research, that led to articles, that led to funding, that led to all the many things I've done in my career. So I guess the best I can do is talk to you about a little bit of my data and what I found out. So when in the early 90s, I was dating someone who was really a wonderful match. And he had a 9-year-old girl, and we basically had a little family, and we took her to Disneyland, and we did a lot of family trips and all the rest of it. And then at one moment, he thought I was dating someone else, but I wasn't. I was just friends with that person. But he used that as the excuse to start engaging a woman he'd met through some mutual friends of ours. And this woman believed that the only reason he was engaging her was that he planned to leave me. And he claimed that he never planned to leave me, and that and so for whatever it was, I said, well, maybe we should try to have a three-way relationship, since you don't want to leave me and you want to be with her, and I'm like a student of adventure. So I met some folks who were in their early engagement of what became known as polyamory. And they didn't really have too many answers for us. So I decided I'd go to Africa, because in Africa, there's a longstanding tradition of polygamy. And the main form of it is polygyny, one husband and multiple wives. Mm-hmm. So I arrive in Africa with this agenda of getting help to deal with my situation. And the Africans were pretty incredulous. They said, so here you are, you're an American woman who is partnered with a man who has met another woman, and but look at yourself. You are a professor. You could leave. You can afford to get divorced. You have a career. We stay in our marriages because we have no recourse. But nonetheless, they did try to help me and tell me their stories of how they'd dealt with what became the title of an article I wrote, and that got reprinted a lot, called Adding a Co-Wife. So I took my dilemma and got all kinds of fascinating story from the Africans. One of the most fascinating ones was that it was like about 1998. And it was the time that Bill Clinton was having the affair with Monica Lewinsky.
Right, right.
And they were all had things to say about this. And they basically said, hey, your American president only has one daughter. You know, that Lady Hillary is probably barren. She's so old. He should marry Monica as a second wife and have a son with her. And then he'll have a legacy. And so they just thought the American idea of, you know, cheating and divorce was so crazy relative to just simply expanding your family.
Interesting. Yeah. That really does bring out.
I learned a lot of logic from them. It was just invaluable. So there's nothing like going to a culture or a country or a place and having a problem that others may be able to help you with.
So that leads to,
you're in the thick of it with them. You're not just, outsider asking.
Oh, yeah.
But I was someone who needed help.
Yeah. Well, more than that, like you said, you were collecting data, but you were collecting personal data. It wasn't just, impersonal objective data. This was data that was important to you.
Oh, sure. But at the same time, I absorb so much that I was able to write some pretty extensive things about this. But I was really embraced by them because I wasn't so different. Yeah. I had the problems that they had.
Yeah. So that's an interesting variation on the question of what theories did you take away from this? But I'm also curious to know, and I'm going to try to get to the heart of it from the American perspective. The American perspective is more of the what you were kind of alluding to a moment ago. One man, one woman, one marriage. You don't cheat on the marriage, all that kind of thing. When you look at that model, which is the model that governs this country, what do you see as its strengths? What do you see as its weaknesses? And do you think it's actually going to sustain over time?
Well, these are excellent questions. And it's a very tricky thing because, we live in a culture that we've absorbed and try to live it as if it's logical. And when I've placed myself in other cultures, their logic becomes fascinating to me, as in them saying he should marry Monica as well. Mm. Now, our pattern of monogamy is at best serial monogamy because so many folks at some point along the way cannot sustain the intensity and passion that may have driven them together as a couple.
And so
they do one of several things. They might start cheating and getting some level of excitement from someone through engaging one or more other people while publicly and even privately maintaining social and economic monogamy. And that is a pretty common model because it's not very disruptive. Because the thing that's really difficult in terms of things like polyamory is that one sees and hears and knows everything. And it's typically painful to think of your beloved acting as intimate with someone else as they are with you. And most people cannot tolerate things like that.
It's an interesting point. I know I went through a divorce a year ago. And this was after a 23-year marriage. And I know that my own take was a little different from other people in our culture in that my ex didn't have an affair. She just left. And when she left, it was very, very traumatic for me because of two things. One, because she left, but two, because she is a former psychotherapist and understands how important communication is in a relationship. And she didn't communicate. And the last few years I was prodding her like, what's going on? Are you okay? Tell me what's happening. I felt for sure she was going to open up and she never did, which really threw me. But the reason I bring that up is I came to the conclusion that the worst thing that happens isn't when somebody cheats on you. The worst thing that happens is when they stop communicating with you. And I'm just kind of curious to know what your take is from what you've seen, all that data you've collected over the years. Yeah. You can hear me. Okay. But somehow your mic still isn't working. Something changed. What could it be? You don't have the mute button isn't on in your browser, is it? This is perplexing. Normally we're able to resolve these things pretty quickly, but today it's just nothing seems to work.
Okay. How is this?
That sounds great. Now we can hear you.
Okay, good. I've had this trouble with StreamYard before.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was, but not, but it's just weird. It happened. And then we tweaked my computer and then it was fine. And we also got okay on my phone. So can you hear me now?
Yeah, you sound great. So
okay, good.
Pick up where we were. Well, we'll just have a whole bunch you'll have to cut out with, from the final edit.
Because right.
I normally don't edit, but when it's that stretched out.
You do need an edit.
Yeah, you got to kind of edit that one out. Yeah.
Okay. So we were talking about serial monogamy and humans and cheating.
Right.
I was saying that polyamory is really tricky because one actually sees and knows about and knows when their partner is with someone else and may even all together share intimacy. And typically the ways that polyamory works the best are conditions under which everybody is kind of tribal. And they all are connected to each other and care about each other and want the best for each other.
The questions I
but really you know, before. It's not everyone who, and most of us didn't grow up with such a model. So it's can either be very liberating or it can be very challenging.
Yeah, that's true.
In Africa, people grow up in a context where they have their mother and then their mother has other co-wives that are living on the compound. And then they have other siblings that are kind of like half siblings, but they all grow up together and they all grow up as family. Now you were asking about, is monogamy a good thing or is it a standard or whatever? It's certainly a way of organizing things. And one of the things that's really unique about American culture, at least North American culture in particular, is that we are a grand experiment in monogamy. Because in old Europe, basically what was going on is the older brother inherited the family farm or that family business and carried on the family name. And the younger brothers were basically Lotharios and they, did not have the means to have their own families because they didn't inherit a business. And thus, they were the ones having these hot love affairs with women who were married to the eldest sons. And, I recall Montaigne even said that it's so droll and dull to be having sex with your spouse. The thing that's interesting and exciting is to have sex with your lover. So at that level, we Western humans have a long tradition of finding intrigue in sex with those who are not our spouses, and that typically marriage was a business proposition where someone had enough resources to be able to run a household, fund a family, and, in cultures where polygamy is acceptable, to fund multiple wives. So here in America, because Indian land rights were not respected by the pilgrims and the settlers, etc., all kinds of men for the first time in generations were able to have a farm of their own. And thus they could have a wife of their own. and children that were theirs. And so we've done more monogamy here than most cultures had ever done.
Mm. Right. And that makes sense. That makes total sense. I think the question I was trying to ask was what the role is of communication. I had made the point that in my own experience, it wasn't so much whether or not my ex had an affair, because actually, as far as I know, she did not have an affair, but rather that the communication had fallen away, which had ultimately undermined the relationship. So I was curious to know what your take is on the idea that relationships are dependent upon communication.
That's a Western idea. Okay. Many cultures don't expect a high level of intimacy or conversation or even romance between a husband and his wife. It's a practical thing. Women are in many places are much more bonded with other women and with their children, and men are bonded with other men. So this idea of couples having each other as their confidants and spiritual partners and best friends is a pretty Western idea. And it's interesting, in Europe, this traditionally was not as high an expectation as we have it. And in fact, there was always secrecy and intrigue between a husband and his wife. And that's perhaps what kept it so alluring, is he really didn't know what was going on with her and vice versa. And so there was a fair amount of heat between them. But we Americans have this notion that men, husbands and wives, should be best friends. Now, how often would you find your best friend really sexually exciting? Not often, because you kind of know them too well. And maybe what makes things exciting is the mystery.
Interesting. Interesting perspective. You give me something to look at from a completely different viewpoint, because I had never looked at it from that viewpoint before.
Yeah. You know, we really hope to have these heart and soul conversations with our partners, where we tell each other these deep stories as we meet about who we are and where we've been. And then we generate much intimacy together and are there with each other through thick and thin. But this is only one model. And it's not necessarily the human model.
Yeah, apparently there are a lot of human models that are quite different from it.
But we still embrace it because we're Americans and we grew up hoping for this. And, you know, and it's sad what happened to you, that, you know, your wife, who had been very conversant in intimacy, at least through her profession, had in so many ways assessed that she didn't want to talk to you anymore.
Mm. Yeah. It was
and she didn't even want to give you the dignify the possibility of having a conversation about this. She just simply assessed that it wasn't right for her.
Right. Yeah, which was what was confusing about it is that it had been right for so many years. And then all of a sudden, at some point, I say all of a sudden, it seemed more of a transition than anything else. But at some point, it transitioned away from that. And I was just left confused.
Yes. Yeah. Now, did she end up partnering with anybody else afterwards?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, for some folks, you know, there's a time for partnership and there's a time for not partnership or for being on your own.
Yep,
or
that was and, her case,
yeah. And I hear this a lot from older women who, you know, they might have been widowed or divorced or whatever, but their interest in being a nurse with a purse is low, and they just don't really have the appetite for the kind of intimacy that they really wanted when they were younger.
Interesting. Very interesting. I also have noticed, because I have been trying to get back out there and meet women again and so forth, I've noticed that there is a different quality, not quality, that's probably not the right word. There is a different set of circumstances associated with older women, because obviously I'm in the older bracket, than when we were all younger, which is that, well, and this is true for both men and women. We've been through a lot. We've been through a lot of experiences, and many of those experiences have trauma associated with them. And so many, I would say at least, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say 90%, probably more, of the women that I've met have some kind of trauma associated that affects how they think about what they want or and what they don't want in relationship. And it, all these various traumas, they basically play one role. They upset the old model, so the model doesn't work anymore. So I find myself trying to figure out, okay, so what's the new model?
Yeah, well, I guess a much younger woman who's not who hasn't experienced any trauma that she can recall.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But then maybe she wouldn't be, you know, that great in terms of all the things that are of interest to you to talk about, and well, yeah, what she likes in music and what her life expectations are might be really, you know, off from what you're looking for.
I think I would be off to her too, because I mean, yeah. I am an older man. I mean, if she's looking to have a family, it's probably not a good match just because of our age difference. It's just,
yeah,
it's just
absolutely. Work, you know? Yeah. So that's not a good idea. But I would think some of what's infused this whole conversation about trauma is the Me Too movement.
Mm, yes.
Because suddenly women and men everywhere were publicly disclosing their traumas, mm-hmm. That involved various levels of assault, abuse, disregard, and rape. Mm-hmm. And thus, we all had the opportunity or circumstance to discuss this and think about it. And then prior to this, largely what folks did was bury it.
Mm-hmm.
Like my mother, for example, had been abused as a young girl by her older brother. Mm-hmm. And there was no conversation about child sexual abuse when she was growing up in the 1920s and 30s. So all she could do was bury it. Mm-hmm. And largely what that led to was her just living a life as if that had not happened, and just being a beautiful woman who had children and who, you know, traveled and, you know, was an activist, and, you know, it was all quite okay until the very last years of her life, when she became demented and began to talk about it. Mm. And because it was like she was sort of so unhinged in terms of propriety that it just became something she, you know, accessed rather easily. And, you know, so some of this just sort of begs the question of how important is it for us to scratch scabs?
Well, that's an interesting question. You can't just leave it hanging there. You have to also give us an answer on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it varies. I think for some folks, you know, if there is this possibility of healing, and we certainly think of relationships as an avenue for healing, then it would make sense to uncover and sort through and discover and rethink and reimagine and make ourselves whole again. But sometimes I think that old adage of putting on a happy face isn't a bad idea.
Expand on that. Tell us what
you think. Oh, well, you know, basically, it comes from this whole idea of faking it until you feel it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but rather
what makes that a good idea, or at least not a bad idea?
Well, because basically you're generating the accoutrements of happiness by looking it, moving it, engaging it. And then at some point, because of your physicality of it, you can then generate it, even if you haven't worked through all that pain. And some folks just dwell in the pain. And, you know, some folks who dwell in the pain basically suffer from chronic depression.
They have no way out of it.
It's just there, and it's deeply biological. And no matter how much you tell them to jump on a trampoline and smile, they can't. It still wells up because of their brain chemistry.
Mm-hmm. I would go a step further. I would say that really all this even transcends the whole question of sexuality. It goes into the heart. The heart and soul, really, of what it is to live in society today. I saw an article recently that pointed to the degree to which under 30s find themselves to feel very disconnected from each other, from society, and so forth. Depression has become a really major issue among that age group. And I keep wondering about what are the societal roles contributing to this, and to what degree are the new roles, the social media roles and so forth, contributing to it? Because that disconnection strikes me as being huge.
It's huge. Yeah. And I would say it has to do with the lack of tangibility. Because if you're living a life on screen where you are not doing face-to-face engagement very often, and maybe you're even a bit trepidatious about being touched or touching someone else or gazing heavily into someone's eyes and experiencing their gaze back. All of this is part of, you know, the kind of intimacy that has been part of human experience. And if instead you're engaging a cyber world that is largely controlled by your fingers on a screen, you're missing something. And it's, and you know, there's, you know, some absolute benefits from our phones and our computers and all that, because we have this sensation of proximity. I mean, you and I are having a deeply thoughtful conversation. You're in Connecticut. I'm in Los Angeles. Yeah. And we're maybe getting into it more deeply than we would if we were meeting for lunch.
In some ways, that's true. Yeah. And yet we're doing it from 3,000 miles away.
And there's a beauty to all of that that we never had access to before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's huge. And in fact, I think that's the part that the internet is kind of missing, because, I mean, we're able to do that here. But I look at the way most social media is structured. Social media is structured around posts and pre-recorded videos. This kind of connection is not a major portion of what happens in the social media world.
No, and we're living, you know, out on a little fringe.
Yeah.
Where every so often, like, I'll get an interview with someone like yourself, and we'll go very deep and have something that, you know, occurs very infrequently. And you're right, like, a lot of stuff is all, you know, 3-minute videos or less, and things that just pop and bang and engage for a tiny bit. And for some folks, their boredom appetites is really high. And if they're not, you know, able to be suddenly laughing and whatever it is, or in shock or whatever emotion they're chasing, they're switching to something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, it's interesting that you mentioned 3 minutes. because I think back to the old record industry, long before we had the digital recordings of today. The records, you know, they were vinyl records that you played on a turntable, and those records were put out by the most successful producers who realized that you want to keep a song to 3 minutes or less so that it would be played on the radio. And it would be played on the radio because that would be the 3 minutes was about the length of the attention span of the person who was listening to it. That was their theory behind it anyway. So, you know, if on those rare occasions where somebody came out with a 6 minute song, oh no, then no one will ever listen to that. You know, as Queen with Bohemian Rhapsody proved very clearly it is not true, but nevertheless, that's the perception. And I think that perception comes out of the basic precepts of marketing. I see the social media today as being an extension of marketing. I'm a marketer, so that's why I think about it in those terms. But as a marketer, I mean, one of the things I've always been frustrated with marketing about is marketing is generally about pushing a pain point, touching on something that's painful to somebody and saying, okay, I've got this solution. And our internet has evolved into this massive world of let's touch pain points and give solutions to everybody. And that's how you create continuity. That's how you create connectivity. That's how all, and it fails. It succeeds in that people get lots of hits. They get lots of attention. But we end up with this society where, it, like you said, the attention span disappears really quickly. People lose interest. They're flipping through all kinds of stuff, which to me means they're really not connecting with anything.
It's tricky thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And sometimes I think we're at such a loss to really generate potent connection. Mm. So just for example, which is actually it was an in-person thing, but I went to a home show in Pasadena last weekend, and there were probably 30 different contractors offering ADUs, which are accessory dwelling units. Okay. And then there were another 20 that were also offering kitchen remodels or bathroom remodels. And you're just like wandering around and grabbing and looking at things. And how do you ever know with that number of people hitting on you that any of them are better than anybody else? Like, why would you go with one versus another? They're all equally there, and all you're really meeting are the salespeople.
Yeah.
You have no idea who the people who they are contracting with are actually going to work.
And you can't really do the same kind of thing that you did when you were collecting all of your data about sexuality. I mean, you could just kind of go from one relationship to the next. You can't just go from one rehab to the next. You'll run out of money real fast. It's not like that you could experiment with that. So you don't have that kind of an option available. So you're really limited.
Right.
And in that limit, you're running into what I think is the, I want to be careful how I say it. You run into the challenge that's involved in facing up to the fact that you're not only working with limited data, but also you aren't really sure what you want. To me, that's another piece.
That's a big thing, because largely what we don't know what we want. Mm-hmm. And especially in relationship, it has to be a co-creation.
Yeah.
It's not like the days of practicality where, you know, a man wanted a woman who knew how to make soap and candles and mm-hmm. how to sew. And mm-hmm. a woman wanted a man who would, you know, bring home some modicum of resources so that mm-hmm. they could fund their lives together and have a family. I mean, that's a very practical exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, largely, those kinds of things are easily purchased.
Right.
You don't have to think about somebody's soap or candle making abilities because you can just buy that stuff very cheaply. And
unless you like buying from a boutique. I mean, there are some people who actually do that as a boutique kind of thing because it's fun and they want to make
soaps
and so forth. But it's not a necessity to go that way.
No, not at all. So what we're looking at is sort of this kismet thing of connection, which, you know, in some moments can feel so amazingly compelling. And then in others, it's not at all. And, you know, it's like, and we can't even explain why, you know, this person is like the cat's meow, and that person is utterly boring. And why then the cat's meow person suddenly becomes so boring that we don't want to ever hear from them again.
I mean, and how is it so that we have not? How can we not have figured that out by now? It seems like we figured everything. How could we not be there? I don't get it.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, think about the whole ghosting phenomena.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's people who have podcasts based on the discussing this. Oh, and yeah. I know I've had, you know, done enough stuff online that I will kind of assess that someone is so not interesting and I'm not interested in having them convince me otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I'll do the standard ghost thing of saying, hey, I met someone else. I'm going to focus on them and then block them in every way I can because I don't want to have a conversation about it.
It does create it's sort of an extension of what we were talking about a moment ago. The fact that we have very short attention spans. And we're it's very easy to get bored, so we're constantly flipping through. That's an extension of that. Ghosting is just part of that phenomenon, really.
Good point. Good point. Yeah.
Or to put it another way,
it's but where
next,
are
next,
we?
Next, 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 next.
And then, how would you ever know that someone is going to be valuable?
Yeah, yeah. That's where
if
the
you've
is.
Never given them a chance.
Yeah. I know a lot of people today, particularly those of us who've been through relationships, marriages, or other kinds of long-term relationships, the relationships end, we find ourselves back out on the market. We find ourselves confused a bit by the modern landscape because the landscape is dominated by dating apps, which we never had when we were previously dating. And the old model, of course, is long gone because we aren't in school anymore. You know, that was like where you had your main source of new potential alliances and meetings and all that kind of thing. So so the whole thing has shifted so much that people are quite understandably confused by it. And it shows up in the statistics. I mean, the percentage of people, older people who actually successfully rematch and you know form that next relationship is quite small out of the whole.
Right. I mean, to start with, they don't have as much need because if they have already had children, they're certainly not wanting to have more. If they already own a home. If they already have a substantial identity in the society, basically, and whatever they're looking for in relationship is more like frosting rather than the whole cake.
Right. Yeah. So it changes the whole dynamic completely.
And again, we see a lot of women having much more to say to other women than to men. And I'm not sure about vice versa. Do men have more to say to other men than to women? Or would men prefer to talk to women?
I think it depends on the man.
Yeah,
I don't think I can draw an across the board on that one.
Yeah, it isn't. But
I mean, speaking for myself, I talk with a lot of women just because I do this podcast.
Right.
But is that true for most men? I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
In fact, now you've got me thinking. You got me thinking about neighbors and so forth. You know, I think about some male neighbors and I think about who I see that they're hanging out with. And some of them are hanging out with male friends I've known for years.
Right.
Others aren't hanging out with anybody. Do I see any hanging out with women who are not their wives? I'm not sure that I see that. So I think there's probably a bias in favor of either the relationship, the primary relationship, or male to male. That's probably where the bias is.
Yeah, and I would say that men, older men tend to be much, who have been widowed or divorced, have typically much more need for a partner than older women do.
Why is that, do you think?
Because they're not as good at socializing and at bringing things to themselves. Okay. And so they had traditionally had depended on their wife or lady partner to, you know, generate the activities and dinner parties and vacations and all that appetite.
So the undeveloped skill actually ends up holding them up.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As so often happens in life, we find that our lives end up funneling into the things that we need to work on the most. There's an example of it.
There you go.
This has been a really interesting conversation. I mean, I've had
absolutely
a lot of fascinating conversations on the show. I've done over 2,000 episodes, so I've had a lot of conversations, but this was really, really interesting. We've gone down.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, every host who invites me and pulls out something different.
It's fun how that works. Yeah. So, well, a couple things we got to get some information on you first.
Sure.
The book, 177 Lovers and Counting, I presume that's available all places that books are available.
Yes. Well, basically, it's available through many different online sites, including my publisher, which is Roman and Littlefield. It's also available on Amazon. It's available on like Walmart, many, many. I think it's just widely available. It's a textbook, though it certainly is also a book that any curious person who's interested in sex and relationship dynamics and history and changes in the culture and cross-cultural research would enjoy. And what happened was I had what was basically a memoir. And when Roman and Littlefield wanted to adopt it, they wanted to adopt it as an anthropology textbook. And being that I'm an anthropologist, I agreed to that. So suddenly it became an autoethnography, which is perfect, which is basically the description of a culture. And I'm so, because I wrote so many journals along the way and saved so many notes and have a really good memory, I was able to recall all these things. And then what I had to do was contextualize all of this. So I ended up doing another dissertation's worth of context generating, both political, historical, sexological, anthropological, sociological, psychological, all kinds of sections are within the book, putting my story in a larger context. So, you know, just an example of the context was abortion. So the year I started having sex was the year that Roe versus Wade became the law of the land.
Oh, okay.
So I always felt that I had backup. But nonetheless, the whole issue of not having backup is huge today for a growing number of states. So, you know, in terms of the whole contextual discussion, there's discussion of what happened with the Supreme Court. And there's discussion with abortion in old Europe, where largely if a man of means who was married to someone and then had an affair with someone else and had a pregnancy without someone else, his desire would be to end that pregnancy so he would not be responsible for that child and have to basically fund that child. So abortion was very practical. It was about maintaining, keeping one's money within the family.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
And it's only a very recent idea that the rights of the unborn have gained such potency. Because prior to this, it just was a non-issue.
It wasn't even an issue. That's really interesting. That's really interesting. We could probably do an entire episode on that one, but
oh, totally. Yeah, every section of my book could be another episode. So
I get the impression too. I mean, you very clearly describe it as a textbook. I get the impression though that it's laced with stories. How much of it is textbook and how much of it is entertaining stories?
Well, we included a glossary, which typically you find in a textbook, and there's an index, and there's a link to all these references of studies I've done, and there's a lot of discussion of kind of the politics of research and the opportunity of research and generating theory and how I generated theory out of what I did. Mm-hmm. But it's all a great story because I'm a good storyteller.
And you enjoy telling the stories too. That makes it even better.
Oh yeah. I just hope every student gets to use this book who is in a class where it's appropriate, and that everybody who's not a student gets a chance to enjoy all the story. And that we are hoping to re-release it as much more of a just a trade book to make it more available and have more bookstores stock it as just a really good read with a lot of fun story and intelligent reflection.
You describe it as an anthropological textbook, but it really sounds more like it would fit in the self-help section. I mean, it sounds like it.
No, I don't think there's any help. at the level of help, it's like finding out that you're not alone and seeing a context for all of your adventures and dilemmas. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways I've certainly healed myself is through awareness. And so I'm keenly aware that whatever I've done and however it's played out in my life is that there is an explanation for it, that it's and that I'm there's this thing called the sociological perspective, where you see yourself in a larger context, and it's not just your personal dilemma, but like it's a human condition. And it could be based on environment, it could be based on demographics, it could be based on economics, but to basically know how to see your quandaries with overlays of reasonable data.
I
think that's helped me immensely. And largely, I have a counseling practice, and it's very much what I do with the people I counsel is give them appropriate information so that they can make sense of of the things that feel problematic, and to understand why they feel that way, and the context of their lives that have generated this sensation. And some of it is cultural waves. Some of it is, economic situations. Some of it is the pandemic. There's many, many things that we can, draw from to explain why we're in pain.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been really interesting. One thing we need to find out how, for somebody who wants to reach out and touch you, so to speak, how do they reach out and touch you?
Oh, yeah, please come touch me. Okay, so I have a website called Wise Woman Sex and Relationship Consulting.com.
Okay.
We'll that website actually has a link to my book on the front page of it. Okay. And I do sessions with folks. You can live anywhere and I'll do a Zoom or a phone session. I'm, you know, a pretty eclectic worker. I, you know, draw from anthropology, sexology, history, and having lived a lot.
And I get that impression. Yeah. I think we all get that impression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very cool stuff. One thing that I also make it a practice to do, and boy, oh boy, does this feel appropriate with you. Because so many guests who come out of the program, everybody is one way or another, they're trying to give back. You know, they've gone through a trauma, perhaps. They've gone through stuff in life. They've learned things. They say, oh, wow, everybody's got to know about this. You kind of did that with your entire life. Your entire life has been about, I got to learn all this stuff, and other people need to know about this too. And so you're kind of like an nth degree giver. You've been giving in a whole bunch of different ways from a perspective that is way outside of what most people have ever thought about, and yet it's a really helpful perspective. I suspect that from the podcasts you've done, I get the impression you've done quite a few of them, and articles written and so forth, there are a lot of people who have consumed what you're saying and what you're talking about. And like everybody else, they're people that you've never met, you've never seen, never will meet, never will see. I noticed a couple of years ago that we don't tend to give or get credit for that. So I like to say, on behalf of those people that you've never met and never seen, never will meet, never will see, thank you for what you're doing. You especially.
Hey, you're welcome. I appreciate that so much because, you know, at some point we've lived so much and seen so much. And, at least through my book, through engaging me, there's this possibility of like sharing some really important and potent stuff.
Yeah. Well, you certainly are doing that. And you gave me a lot to think about too. I think you gave our listeners a lot to think about.
Good.
Yeah. So thank you very much. So Dr. Leanna Wolf, thank you for joining me. Thank you for sharing all this stuff. Thank you for writing your book. I hope it continues to do very, very well. And we wish you all the more happiness and joy as you. I mean, I kind of suspect that the journey isn't over. You've got more research you're going to be doing, more data you're
collecting. Oh, endless research. Yeah, there's always research to be done.
So is there going to be another book coming along at some point?
Probably. I know I wanted to add some more stories to this book that you know, when it's like I was generating stories and thinking back on things that I hadn't included. And so, you know, the moment there's the green light for a second edition, there'll be more stories popped in.
It sounds good. Okay. So we'll be looking forward to that as well. So thank you again. We appreciate you joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you to our podcast listeners everywhere. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.